You're listening to Daily Paul Radio. Revolutionary talk for revolutionary times. WGRR Digital.
Welcome to this week's edition of Blue Republican Radio. Thank you for joining me. As many of you know, this is recorded up in Seattle. That's my home city. And there's some interesting things have been going on up here in Washington State that probably increasingly have relevance to the rest of the nation. In a city near Seattle, SeaTac, which is where Seattle's airport is, there has recently been a successful initiative to raise the minimum wage to a rather large $15 an hour. Now, obviously, people all over the political spectrum have strong feelings about the minimum wage. And the gentleman that I will be speaking to today, Rick Forschler, is a former SeaTac City Council member who lost his position effectively on the same ballot that brought in the $15 minimum wage. Rick, welcome to the show.
Hi, Robin. Thank you.
Now, the reason I've got you on is that this is an issue, this minimum wage issue, this is something that you know a lot about, you've been involved in for a long time, and indeed, you mentioned to me before the show that it was no coincidence that you lost your seat on the SeaTac City Council at the same time that the $15 minimum wage was brought in here, because everybody knew that you had been campaigning against it. Now, the reason I want to get you on the show to discuss this is not just because of your expertise in this area, but what SeaTac has done is actually very dramatic in this area, right? Like, I think a lot of people are kind of used to these incremental hikes in the minimum wage, and they often don't create a lot of furore. But here, when you're going to $15 from, what was the minimum wage before?
Well, it was governed simply by Washington State's minimum wage, so it was $9.19 prior
right.
to it going up.
So this is a massive, this is effectively a two-thirds increase, around 67% in one
shot.
It was
about 63%.
Okay, so Rick, let's start by giving the listeners, Blue Republican Radio here, some background. How did we get to this point? How has this happened? What's the kind of popular feeling about this in SeaTac? And now, why are people in Seattle so exercised, the major city of Seattle, so exercised about what's been happening in SeaTac?
Well, I think people see what happened in SeaTac as some people see it as a first step, it was successful only by 77 votes, but it did pass successfully in SeaTac. And the people that are trying to promote higher minimum wages are using that as an example that it gained popular support. And so it's I guess you could say it's just a marketing thing for them to use as they try to get the higher minimum wages in other places.
Nothing succeeds like success, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm. So, go ahead.
And so you asked me a number of things there. Correct me if I don't get them all. What brought this about, I guess it was about a year ago, a little under a year ago, when I first heard this. And at the time, the idea of a $15 an hour wage sounded pretty preposterous. Yet they've had a very successful campaign since then to convince people that it's a reasonable thing. And, yeah, passed in November. Did you want me to talk about some of the consequences of this already?
No, absolutely. Let's just, cue the listeners in to what effects, if any, so far this has had.
Okay, so this went into effect at the first of the year, so we're only about a little over 3 months into it. I've only interviewed 6 businesses. There's many more of them that were affected, but out of those 6, I've identified that 1.5% of the people that were affected by this have already lost their jobs. I'm sure there's more than that, but I just haven't had time to catch up with them. And some of the businesses are, frankly, a little skittish. They don't want to be, putting a lot of information out there that is going to scare either their employees or other investors in their company or customers in their company. So they're not real keen in talking about it. So, but anyway, 1.5% is a definite, and because SeaTac surrounds the airport, it's a very seasonal business model for all the businesses. So they build up in the summertime when a lot of people are flying and traveling, and then it goes down again in the wintertime. So what's happening here is they're starting to build up for the summer. There's signs up for hiring people for $15 an hour. Of course, they're screening their applicants a lot more closely than they used to, because now they can command people with more experience, people that have skills. They'll hire someone for a job that can do two or three different skills that they didn't need before. They might be someone that can do work at the front desk, but they can also do some work at updating web pages or something. No, more skills, something that they can use to spread that employee across a broader range of tasks at their company. And so, when they bring in these people with more skills during the summertime, when they come to the wintertime now and they have to cut back again, they're not going to cut back the people with more skills. They're going to cut back the people that temporarily are getting $15 an hour but don't have skills that match that. So the number of people that ultimately lose their jobs that at first thought they were going to be making more money is going to be a lot greater by the end of this year.
Now, this 1.5% number, Rick, let me just make sure I understand this. Are you saying that, I mean, I realize this is, you know, not a kind of a scientific sampling you've taken, but
right.
But this 1.5% implies that for every 100 people, employees who were earning less than 15%, 1.5% of them have been made redundant. Is that right? Sorry, who were earning less than $15 an hour, 1.5% of them are now redundant?
1.5% are gone. They've lost their
yes.
jobs. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now, so the first thought that people who would oppose you on this would have probably would be 63% increase in wage, and you only lose 1.5% of jobs. That's a good deal.
Well, okay. So 1.5 is, like I said, I've only interviewed 6 businesses. So there's a good deal more businesses that are affected by this in SeaTac. And so I know that numbers. A lot greater than that, but I don't.
Oh,
feel
sorry. Hold on. You're not talking about 1.5% of those businesses' employees, or
no,
are you?
I'm talking 1.5% of all that are affected.
Oh, you mean in the entire in SeaTac itself?
Yes.
Right. Oh my goodness.
So
this is now a big number.
Right. Right.
So I get it.
If I were to interview more and more businesses, that number would grow. You know, probably 5, 6, 7% pretty easily. That's just a guess on my part because I haven't interviewed them. I don't know yet.
Okay.
But there's obviously quite a few that have already lost their jobs, and by the end of the year, there will be quite a few more that have lost their jobs and are replaced by people with greater skills that actually can command a $15 an hour wage.
Now, do you know, Rick, how much does it actually cost a business, roughly, to employ somebody at $15 an hour? Because obviously it costs them much more than $15 an hour, right?
You know, that's a good question, and I'm sorry I don't have those numbers. I could probably find them out.
Okay.
But yeah, it'd be better to ask someone that's actually employing folks.
Do you know roughly, and you may not have the answer to this either, which is fine, but I want to ask it. What proportion of costs wages actually represent for some of these businesses that you've spoken to in SeaTac?
In every case that I've talked to, labor is their largest cost. So when it goes up by such a significant amount, it definitely has impact. Now, it's going to vary from one business to another depending on their business model. In SeaTac, we have hotels, restaurants, parking facilities, park and fly rental cars, you know, a variety of different businesses that are impacted, and they'll all have different models that say their employment costs are greater than some other one. The ones I've heard are anywhere from 40 to 60%. I guess that's just a guess on my part, but I would guess that's probably a range. 40 to 60% of their overall cost is labor.
So, well, this is shocking because that means that a 63% hike in wages at the bottom end is going to have certainly a double-digit impact on the cost in terms of percentages, on the cost of businesses that hire a lot of lower-end labor.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Well, now, Okay, so let me qualify that a little bit. 63% increase was as of last year when the minimum wage was $9.19. Now it went up because of the state cost of living increase to $9.32 this year, all on its own anyway. Mm. So it's a little less than that, you know, around 60%. But when we were talking about it last year, it was 63%.
Right.
Also the I'm sorry, take me back just a minute ago. I was addressing the question that you just asked, and I'm losing my train of thought.
Well, you know what? We're going into a break, so we've got some time. We'll come back to it after the break.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Blue Republican Radio. When we went into the break there, Rick, you wanted to make a point, and then you got cut off by the music.
Yeah, thank you. So the point was the amount, 63% that the wages were going up, would be assuming that everybody was making minimum wage. Well, not all of them were. Some were making, sure, who knows, $11, $12, $13 an hour. Some of them may have been making close to 15 already. And so when those ones go up, it wouldn't be as great as 63%. That was the only way to point out.
Yeah, that's why I said, you know, it probably represents a double-digit percentage increase in the wages for these businesses that have a lot of low-end labor. But it wouldn't be, you know, 50% times the 63%, say. But we're still talking significant percentages, aren't we? That's the point. And significant percentages that you have determined have already resulted in people being laid off, which brings me to another question. When you've got, you know, hundreds of people being laid off by something that I guess in many instances they supported, is there now some kind of popular reaction? Like, are opinions changing? Is there any kind of movement against this now?
I don't think this fact is well known. Like I said, it was only since the first of the year, and okay. I've uncovered this by interviewing people myself. I haven't seen this reported anywhere else other than from when I've talked to people.
But it must be easy enough to find some of these people who have been laid off.
Actually, it's hard to find the people that I've talked to, the businesses. The people themselves, the businesses won't tell me who they are because of, I guess, privacy. The only one that I know of is one that had been laid off, and he applied for work in another location. And that employer told me that he had an applicant, but he didn't feel comfortable sharing the name with me either. So I don't really have names for any of these people, but I know they're out there.
But there was a popular movement to institute this $15 minimum wage, and a lot of the people who thought they would benefit from it now are discovering the opposite is true. I wonder if they will organize against it, to undo it.
I would love to hear from them. I don't know if any of them might by chance be listening to this program or other programs, but if they're willing to come forward and tell their story, that would be great to get out in for the public to hear.
Absolutely. Now you said about businesses now trying to hire people with more skills. When you've got a business that needs a disproportionate amount of lower skilled labor, like let's say a hotel, what is the actual practical impact on their business? Because, you know, they can't have, for example, everybody who's cleaning the room working on their website. So how are they managing that?
The ordinance in SeaTac had some provisions. For instance, it only affected hotels that had over 100 rooms and over 30 employees. So if they lay a few employees off, they get under the quantity of 30, and now they don't have to pay them the $15 an hour. Or, in one case, one of them just closed up some rooms. They said, we're not going to use these rooms. And they got down under the 100 rooms. And so they didn't have to pay the $15 an hour.
Wow.
So that was some unintended consequences of the ordinance. But those people are making less revenue as well now because they've had to close some rooms.
Now, when you say unintended consequence, I'm guessing people like you, Rick, could see this coming.
Oh, of course.
Now,
yeah.
So what did your opponents, the advocates for $15 minimum wage, what did they say when they were presented with those arguments? Were they like, oh, well, that's just a price worth paying, a few layoffs and, you know, reduced economic activity, that's a price worth paying? Was that, like, what was their justification?
I think, looking back, it's hard for me to say that they had just one rationale for that. They had a variety of excuses that they used. But it was that, yeah, we're talking about low quantities of numbers. Sometimes they would try to discount our arguments as being, you know, you're only speaking for big business. You're not, really a true spokesman of the facts. They had a variety of things they used. All of them were kind of insulting in a sense because they didn't give any validity to the real facts,
yeah.
The real concerns.
Uh-huh. Now, in your work on this issue, you've encountered some interesting, let's say, tactics that have been used in defense of this large minimum wage hike in SeaTac. Tell me a little bit about those.
Okay, so there's a couple different ones I can cover. Let me start with one. I call it the spiral of silence, and it's based on a mass media manipulation tactic. And if people want to Google the word spiral of silence, look it up in Wikipedia, they'll get a pretty good idea how it works. But in a nutshell, what it is the more people believe that their own opinion is in the minority, the more they remain silent. And so what the opponents have to do is they have to convince everybody that $15 an hour is reasonable, and that if they don't think it's reasonable, then they're in the minority and they should just remain silent. And the way they do that is through protests, waving signs, shouting, marching in front of businesses that they want to vilify. And then all that gets on the media, on the news, and people see it and they begin to think, wow, you know, $15 an hour must be something, must be okay because it's getting so much attention. Mm-hmm. So, I told you earlier, a year ago, it was seemed preposterous that anyone would propose $15 an hour. Now it's talked about all over the place and almost thinking that people think of it as reasonable. And that's happened because of this technique that they're using. And so,
so
during, During the CTAC campaign, this was one of our weaknesses. We were treating this like any other campaign, and it became aware, obvious to me pretty quick that what the opponents were doing, they were not treating it like a campaign. They were treating it like a social movement. And people would come home from work, and they would see the news, and they would see people protesting in Chicago and New York and, Detroit for $15 an hour at fast food restaurants. And so what it really was just a handful of people around the country scattered around getting in the news media and continuing to get this drumbeat in everybody's brain that, hey, $15 an hour should be the minimum wage. They addressed this as a nationwide campaign, got it in the news media all over, and when people came home from work, they would turn on their news and they would see that, and it influenced the voters in CTAC because of a national campaign.
Well, so a couple of questions then. Where did this $15 number come from? Who came up with that? Why 15? Why not 12? Why not 18?
Well, I don't actually know, but I can tell you one thing that was a very perverse incentive for this. There was included in the ordinance in CTAC is a provision that if a business is unionized, then the collective bargaining agreement rules over it, not the minimum wage. And so, in other words, if they have a collective bargaining agreement that is for like $12 an hour, then the employer does not have to pay $15. And so it was almost in their benefit to make it as egregious as possible for a business to be able to stay in business. So the higher the number they go, the better it was. And this is in CTAC, but I believe this is going to be true. And I believe you'll find the same language in all the ordinances that they propose, that they're exempted if they're a union. And so here's the scenario that plays out. A business says, wow, all of a sudden we have to pay $15 an hour. We're going to go out of business. He talks to his employees and he says, I'm sorry, we're going to have to close the business down. You're all going to lose your jobs unless, of course, you unionize. And then we can bargain down the wages to something that will allow us to keep the business. But in the process, of course, now they have more union members, more union dues. So that $15 an hour is bait.
Another way of looking at this would be to say it's not a minimum wage bill. It's state-sponsored unionization of labor. I mean, it's a Marxism bill.
I never said it that way, but you could say that. It's a state-driven motivation to unionize all the workers.
Yeah, I mean, massively so, right? Now, So another interesting question that comes out of what you just said. If there were so many national interests and money, I guess, from outside CTAC, supporting this effort for this $15 minimum wage, what was it about CTAC that made this that caused this effort to gain traction there? We're at the break already.
Okay.
Welcome back to Blue Republican Radio for the Liberty Curious. And when we went into the break, I was asking my guest, Rick Forschler, Rick, what do you think it is about SeaTac or SeaTac's politics that caused the national effort for a massive hike in the minimum wage to be successful in this one part of America?
Well, you could say that SeaTac was low-hanging fruit. It had a very small number of voters. It had a huge commercial interest because it completely surrounded the SeaTac airport, which is the largest airport till you, I think you get down to about the Bay Area or something. So it was just and plus it had a lot of progressive liberal type voters that would be inclined to approve a minimum wage hike. So it just all those pieces came together to make SeaTac an ideal place for them to try this first.
Do you think this could be a good thing in the long run for people who care about the free market? Because here's this small little laboratory where we will see the consequences of a $15 minimum wage over time, and that might possess other cities not to go there.
Well, I hope so, because I do think it's possible that the consequences will be so obvious it's hard to ignore. In the past, minimum wage increases have been relatively modest and pretty much tracked close to inflation. Not exactly, but close. And so it was easy to ignore the increases, but this is way out of line. It's huge, and so the impact should be obvious for everyone to see, and the consequences may be positive in the long run because it'll convince people that minimum wage laws are a negative thing.
Are people like you, in colleagues, people who believe like you, are you organizing to actually, I mean, we talked about finding the people who've been hurt, but we should be advertising to find those people and building a campaign around them, around, you know, the people who this, I guess, was supposed to help, whom it's hurt, and make this into a popular and maybe even populist cause.
So, yes, we did. We started an organization called Sustainable Wages. In fact, you can go to sustainablewages.org. Most of our focus has been in Seattle right now because that's where the next big push after SeaTac is gone. But like we were talking about earlier, this really needs to be a nationwide thing because the news is nationwide. People get their news nationwide, and that's influencing their opinion. And so what we're doing is we're already growing. We've got three new chapters, one in Tacoma, Washington, one in Minneapolis, and one in Indiana. And so we're going to use those chapters to start influencing the same media attention that has been created by the people trying to promote this minimum wage and take away some of their media and counteract it so that we can break that spiral of silence.
So, yeah, what you're saying is we've got to meet this national effort with a national effort.
That's exactly right. So I don't know how broad your audience is, but if people...
It's national.
That's great. If people can go to our website, sustainablewages.org, and click the volunteer button, or there's a page for volunteering. Send us their email address. Let us know if they're interested in helping start a chapter in somewhere else in the country. We really need their help, and I think it'll be an effective way to counter this. Not only the SeaTac, and Seattle efforts that are going on now, but there are minimum wage battles going on all over the country. In fact, the federal minimum wage. We can work together on all those issues. So, if people can go to that website and help us bring the media to different areas, it'll help amplify our message.
Sure. Now, thanks for that. Let me just ask you about Seattle, being that it's next door to SeaTac. How are things looking now with respect to this issue in Seattle? What has the success of the minimum wage hikers in SeaTac, what influence has that had on the state of this issue in Seattle? Is anything kind of impending in Seattle?
Yes. In fact, just today, the 15 Now campaign, which is those are the people trying to get $15 an hour approved, they announced that they're filing, it's either an initiative or a charter amendment, I'm not sure which, with the city of Seattle to get it on the ballot in November. So, yeah, they're aggressive. And they're using the momentum that built out of SeaTac to try convincing people in Seattle that it should be done there as well.
I can't help thinking that when you've got people who are low income, what in the country of my birth we would call, you know, solidly working class, and that, by the way, is not a derogatory term in any sense. Yeah, when you've got those people on TV with banners, the only thing that's kind of going to counter that is going to be the same kind of people, elements from the same part of our culture with opposing banners, right? Otherwise, it always is going to look like the rich, the connect, you know what I mean?
You're right, although appearances are deceiving because from what I've been able to tell, most of the people out there carrying banners are not the working class folks. They are the union members that are trying to encourage more unionization and more union dues coming in. I know for a fact some of them are paid. They're not just volunteers.
I don't know how
many of them are, but...
That is such an essential point. You know, this speaks to a bigger, bigger point. This almost says, you know what, again, this isn't about minimum wage. The unions have a law that looks like a minimum wage law that is written to promote unionization, right? Basically, this law is written to move money to unions. Of course they're going to pay people to walk up and down with banners because it's in their financial interest to do so, which is kind of ironic, isn't it?
Yes, and so the people we need to have are really the working class folks. And the small businesses especially are going to be harmed. But this brings up another irony, too, and this one is kind of a touchy subject because I really don't want to alienate the larger businesses because they're damaged, too. But the larger businesses can cope with this better than the small ones.
Thank you for raising that. I was thinking that. Please go ahead. Talk about that. Yeah.
Okay, so the larger businesses, they buy in mass quantity, you know, of goods. They can get price breaks on large quantities. They also have administrative costs. They can spread across thousands of different departments or workers, where small business, they don't. They have everything that a big business has to do with financial obligations, with purchasing, with HR. All of that has to happen, but it happens over a smaller body of people. So their individual costs are much higher. So when you raise $15 an hour, make $15 an hour as a minimum wage, all of a sudden it disproportionately damages the small
Absolutely.
Businesses than it does the big ones. And so here's the irony, and this is, I guess, the dirty little secret that is difficult for people to talk about, is that there are businesses out there, larger businesses, that are getting behind this $15 an hour because they say, well, we can live with it. We're already paying $15 an hour or we're pretty close to it, but when this happens, we're also going to drive out our low-cost competitors.
It's anti-competitive. Yeah. It's like when, at the federal level, big pharma, big oil, whoever it is, big defense, sit down with big health insurance. Let's do that one, right? Because that's topical.
Right.
Sit down with the legislators and write regulations that they can afford to comply with, but the up-and-coming competitors who will compete against them cannot. It is anti-competitive. And therefore, in the long run, it is bad. It's obviously bad for small business directly, but it's bad for the people who will be employed by those small businesses. And those small businesses, we all know, are the engines of employment in America.
Oh, yes. Yeah, it's going to be one of the things, the way we characterize this is that we need to keep Seattle local. You know, we want them to be small, independent businesses rather than big box stores and national chains, because the big ones are the ones that are going to be able to cope with it, where the small ones can't. However, I need to clarify one thing here. Not all the big businesses are taking that approach. I don't want to vilify them either. You know, some of them are damaged by it, and we need them in this fight as well. So I don't want to make them think that we're against them. We're trying to carry this battle for everybody.
And just also to make clear, we've talked about union, you know, union shenanigans here. But, you know, for want of a better label, a classical liberal myself, I'm not against labor organizing as long as they're doing it voluntarily, as long as they're doing it in a way that does not forcibly penalize those who may not want to join those organizations. As long as, you know, to use the parlance that we hear in this country, everybody has a right to work and a right to work on a level playing field.
Right.
Yeah.
So maybe I should just clarify as well that for most of my working career, about two-thirds of my working career, I was a union member myself. I was a machinist, member of International Association of Machinists and Aerospace Workers. When I was at Boeing, I was a member of SPIA, which is the Professional Engineering Association. I'm in favor of unions myself. It's just when they use tactics like this that are so self-serving and damaging to other small businesses, it's wrong. It hurts everybody. So, So anyway, I'm in agreement with you on that point.
Was the support? We'll come on to another topic in a second. But was the support for this from within the political? I guess the small political class of SeaTac. Was it along party lines?
I wouldn't say so. I would say more so on the liberal progressive side. But when you had people that were small business owners or had been involved with small business in the past, they were able to recognize this, no matter what party they were a part of. They
right.
could see it as bad.
Interesting. Yeah, there you go. That said so much.
Now, so I'll say this in Seattle as well, is this we're attracting people from all over the political spectrum, that folks that especially small business owners who view themselves as very liberal and progressive, and yet they realize that this is a bad thing for their business and for Seattle as a whole. And so sustainable wages is nonpartisan, and we're attracting people from all over the political spectrum.
And just so I'm clear, the legislation that might come up, or the initiative that might come up in Seattle, will it be of the same form that, the incentivizing the unionization?
Almost certainly.
Okay.
I haven't seen it yet, because like I said, they're just filing it today, but almost that this, what I've done is I've taken key parts of that language and I've Googled it, and found that in every case that I'm aware across the country where they've gone for high minimum wages, that language is there. In fact, that language was in Seattle for the safe and sick pay that was approved, what was it, a year or two years ago? That language was there as well, that if there was a collective bargaining agreement, it ruled rather than the law. So it's almost for sure that it will be a part of this as well.
Okay. Now, before we went on air, Rick, you were telling me something else that was interesting about the tactics that you have been having to deal with. We talked about Lawfare and slap lawsuits. Tell me a bit about that.
Yes, so Lawfare is a rather new term. The term slap has been around longer. It stands for a strategic lawsuit against public participation. And what they do is they'll file lawsuits against organizations, corporations, individuals, whoever they want to vilify. And they do that not because they really want to win the lawsuit. They do that because they get PR and media attention for it. And so they have to have something of substance, but it only has to be enough that a judge won't throw it out in court. They can have spurious information, bad information. And what happens is they come out and say, well, look at this lawsuit that we filed, that these evil people that are doing something to their employees, or they're not paying them properly, or they're not giving them the tips properly, or in the case of some companies, where they have a requirement that they compensate them for doing their laundry or something for uniforms, they'll come up with something that seems like it has some substance. They'll file a lawsuit, and then they'll announce in the press that this lawsuit has been filed against this company, these people.
Mm-hmm.
Well, some of the bigger companies, they can cope with it. They can handle it. But when the small companies or small businesses are hit with this, they're defenseless. They don't have the resources to defend themselves in court. And we know there are other organizations out there that specialize in this kind of thing, in the slap and lawfare. And they've announced that they are coming to Seattle to participate in the minimum wage issue. So we know this is going to happen. And what we've done is we've started a legal defense fund to help small businesses to defend themselves against this.
Ah, that's interesting. And is this like Who started this fund and who's throwing into it? Is it small business kind of, it's like a small business cooperative? Like an mutual
thing? I actually got it started before we started the group called Sustainable Wages Seattle, but it's growing now because we're using it to help sustainable wages. And if they go to the sustainablewages.org website, you can read more about it. In fact, we have a place there where people can donate into the legal defense fund if they would like. We really need the help, because when this hits, the legal expenses get very expensive.
Mm. Now, what do you say to the notion, just to go back to the minimum wage issue itself, because I know a lot of people feel this, and this is why it's such a difficult issue. There's just this kind of basic sense of social justice that says if you're working 8 hours a day, 5 days a week, you should be able to live off what you earn. Do you agree with that, or do you not agree with that?
Wow. You know, that's different based on a person's expectations of why they work. It depends. It's going to be different for every person in every situation. If you look at the statistics, most people working in minimum wage jobs are people that are not trying to support a family. They are living with someone else. They're living with their parents or somewhere where they're sharing the costs. They may be using it for college tuition. They might be using it for spending money. But it's not, by and large, a living wage. It's something that they use to carry them through until they gain more experience, more skills, that they can have a career later.
Okay, so let me ask you a question, Rick. Because I know this is a reasonable, I believe it's a reasonable concern that people have against your position, which is, would you say then, in that case, let's grant that, if we got to a point where we knew that a large minority or even a majority of people on low, you know what? My goodness, I'm not going to ask you that because the segment is over. We will be back in a few minutes.
Okay, thank you.
I'm sure some of you all were wondering what it was I was going to ask Rick. And what I was going to ask him was, if it were the case that we knew, as a matter of data, that a significant number or even a majority of people on low income, low wages, were actually bringing up a family or had any dependents, would that change your view about the minimum wage?
No, I'm afraid it wouldn't. The reason is because we need those minimum wage, those entry-level jobs for people, for other people who also are trying to get into the workforce. It's a stepping stone job for career growth. And so right. those people that are trying to support a family on that, the best thing we can do is to help them to grow into better jobs, into a career that earns more money, rather than trying to have them persist in a job which doesn't pay much. Yeah. It's far better to have them move into something where they can actually earn something that benefits their family and provides them with a living wage that is worth their time and their effort at becoming more proficient. Mm. So career development is what we need to focus on, get those people into better jobs.
And that would be a good topic for another show. You're certainly right to make the point that, or maybe another, 100 shows, certainly right to make the point that it's very hard to get on a ladder if the ladder doesn't have the three rungs at the bottom.
That's right.
So we've got just a minute or so, Rick. For the listeners, anybody that wants that cares about this issue, where can they go?
So we really need people's help. If they could go to sustainablewages.org, and we've got two ways they can donate. We've got a volunteer page. We need to grow this as a nationwide organization. It's not just Seattle. So I invite anybody that is willing to help us, please go to sustainablewages.org and sign up to help us. Thank you for asking.
Yeah, and just to reiterate, there is, in Seattle at least, some urgency, because we expect that by the end of May, the city council, the city of Seattle, will have decided whether to impose a massive minimum wage hike in Seattle. Is that right?
Yes, I'm not sure exactly when, but I believe near the end of May they're trying to make a decision of whether or not the council will impose this $15 an hour themselves. They really shouldn't do that. We need to convince them that they should let the process work. If people are collecting signatures to put it on the ballot, let it go to the ballot.
Okay. Thanks very much, Rick. Thank you for your time. Thanks for joining me, everyone. Tune in next week for Blue Republican Radio for the Liberty Curie.
You're listening to Daily Paul Radio, revolutionary talk for revolutionary times, WGRR Digital.